Time is 1:02 PM. Members present at this time, Representative Tuck, Representative Hannon, Representative Tallarico, Representative Sponholz, myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Ms. Debbie Tillinghast. Thank you so much. And our LIO moderator, Flannery Ballard. Thank you. Today we have three items before us, HB 35, HJR 10, and HB 16. We're going to start with HB 35, and then we'll go on to the other items. We do have Matt here from Representative Stute's office, if you want to come forward. Also with us today, available to answer questions, are Glenn Haight, the Executive Director of the Alaska Board of Fisheries, Christy Tibbles, the Executive Director, Alaska Board of Game, Alpheus Bullard, who's the drafter with Ledge Legal, is also online, and Cheryl Brooking, Natural Resources Attorney Law from Department of Law, is supposed to be online. I do not see that individual online, though, at this time. So do you want to give us a brief recap, Mr. Greening?
Yes, Madam Chair. Through the chair, members of the House Resources Committee, thank you again for the second opportunity to present. I just wanted to go over a few things. With the chair's permission, I wanted to bring members' attention to two new documents in the packet. One is a letter of support from Cordova District Fishermen United, and the other is a response to testimony from the United Fishermen of Alaska. The letter from UFA speaks very succinctly and very eloquently to why a board member being able to deliberate in the final stage of the process is critical to the intent of this bill, as well as fixing the problem that we're trying to get at here. In wrap-up, I just wanted to remind the committee that all this bill does is allow members who have a declared conflict of interest to deliberate on a proposal before recusing themselves from the vote. It makes no changes to anyone's ability to vote or any changes to how a conflict is determined. It comes with no cost to the state. It's a common sense solution to a decades-old problem that is impairing the ability of these two boards to operate effectively and transparently. The sponsor asks for your support and thanks you for your consideration. At that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Are there any questions for the bill sponsor staff? Or any of the individuals we have who have joined us today? Okay. Seeing no questions, we didn't have any amendments turned in. I would entertain a motion.
I move the CS for House Bill 35 Fisheries, version SLLS0297/U, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Hearing no objection, that bill will move from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Here, the time is 1:09 p.m. We have been joined by Representative Rauscher about 5 minutes ago, so please let the record reflect his attendance. And we are going to swap the order and go to HJR 10 next, and then we'll do HB 16 third today. So I know online we have some individuals, Jason Hoke from the Copper Valley Development Association, John Duhamel from Copper Valley Electric Association, and Crystal Enquist from Alaska Power Association. So Representative Tallarico and staff, if you want to get started, let me know at what point we're bringing those people into the presentation. That'd be wonderful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate being here today, and as well as the committee members, for hearing House Joint Resolution 10. For the record, I am Dave Tallarico, and I represent House District 6, which is the eastern interior of the state of Alaska, mostly the eastern interior. And I have with me my staff member, Julie Morris, as well today. Madam Chair, House Joint Resolution 10 would promote the development of the Road Belt Electrical Intertie Transmission Line. That would be a high-voltage electrical line running from Sutton to Glen Allen, where a sub-transmission line would extend to Gakona and on to Tok and north through the upper Tanana region to Delta Junction. And the final leg of the project would run from near Delta Junction, just south of Fort Greeley, back to Gakona, basically creating a complete connection and a full loop connecting both the road belt intertie and the rail belt intertie together. So it would be one complete system and a complete grid, so to speak, right in the center of the state. This resolution supports that infrastructure development, and what it entails, it not only provides us energy in areas where it's needed, but national security, economic development, natural resource development for the state of Alaska. High voltage electrical line would create what they refer to as a bus loop. So in other words, it would establish a second path for power transmission from Anchorage to Fairbanks, which is needed during disasters such as earthquakes. And I'm reminded of the earthquake back in November when there was some power interruption from the southern side of Anchorage. There was actually power available via the rail belt intertie from the north, so that we didn't have the type of interruption we would have typically had prior to the rail belt intertie being put in, which was incredibly important for our emergency responders and our communications and things. So with the infrastructure development and the increase in population at Eielson Air Force Base, Fort Greely, and Clear Air Force Station, the need for power in the region will increase significantly. The resolution urges Congress to advocate for the security of the nation's northernmost military and oil infrastructure by pursuing the development of the road belt intertie. This is a project long overdue for Alaska, and I ask for your support for this resolution. And Madam Chair, if I could say, it's certainly no surprise to anyone that I don't think we've just recently been discovered, but we are obviously turning into a national security stronghold for the United States with the development and the incredible amount of infrastructure investment that we're seeing currently, which includes more missile silos at Fort Greely, the F-35s at Eielson Air Force Base, and the long-distance radar at Clear. I think from my own perspective and national security, I would like to make sure that, first of all, that we never have to push a button or launch a plane to secure ourselves. But if we did, that we would be well prepared to keep power to those facilities, particularly those facilities. I almost, you know, there's always, and I don't want to get into this debate, but there's certainly been a lot to talk about a wall and a wall on the southern border. And sometimes I compare the missile silos at Fort Greely are kind of our northern border wall. And security that I think is very important for us. But we would also, of course, and it's no secret, that we would be able to take advantage of a lot of development in a somewhat undeveloped area in Alaska, which has, of course, it's in my district, and Representative Rauscher and I kind of share this border there, which has incredible potential for agriculture and tourism and all of those things. So with that, Madam Chair, if there are any questions, I can certainly answer those, or if you choose to move to the presentations, there are people that can explain this much better than I can.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. Any questions at this time? Okay. Then I don't know if you want to stay there or come back and join us.
Madam Chair, I'm more comfortable in my regular chair. Thank you.
Then I think we're going to go to Jason. And he's going to do this presentation for us here. So, Jason, and I'm saying Hoke, and I don't know if that's correct, so apologize if it's not. But
you are correct, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Okay, great.
Am I all queued up with the PowerPoint presentation, Madam Chair?
You are. And I think Julie's right. Going to help you with switching the slides.
Okay. Well, my name is Jason Hoke. I'm the president of the Board of Directors for the Copper Valley Development Association. We are the ARDER. Out here in the Copper Valley through the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I've been at this post for 10 years now. I am also the Programs Director for Otna Intertribal Resource Commission and have been for a little over a year now, working with tribes on energy issues as well as development. But that being said, I'll go to my next slide. Okay, this is not Rivet's first rodeo. Historically, this project was considered back in the late 80s and 90s. It has been studied and studied. It even kind of got dusted off and restudied back in, I believe it was 2012 or 14, under the Susitna-Wantana project. So Copper Valley Electric has been keeping track of all of this information, and it is all right there on that website here on the PowerPoint if you'd like to check it out. Current project proposed transmission runs. Phase one would go from Sutton to Glen Allen to Delta, and that would be the big Kahuna line. That would be the 138 kilovolt to 245 kilovolt. Phase two would be the smaller subtransmission line from Gakona to Tok to Delta, approximately 227 miles. All of these lines could utilize the existing rights of ways, with the exception of about 100 miles of gaps. So in other words, we already have lines running through all of this area. They're just not transmission lines. They're distribution lines. And I'll let my cohort in Rivet, Mr. Duhamel, explain that later on, the difference of those two. It completes a bus loop, as Representative Tallarico had said, around the road system of Interior Alaska, connecting to the rail belt. Why is that bus loop necessary? Redundancy, whether it be earthquake, avalanche, attack, or some other reason of power going out, we have a secondary way of pumping it through up to Fairbanks and around the loop. And we're talking about electrifying an area the size of Montana. When I talk to some of the folks in D.C. about it, they just can't kind of wrap their mind around the fact that we don't have that size of a grid out in this area. Next slide, please. Here are a couple maps. The larger map is a more comprehensive map, which kind of shows going from down in Sutton up through to Glen Ellen, north to Delta Junction, as well as the sub-transmission line. As you can see, there are pointed out a number of renewable energy resources that could be tapped into, as well as a potential natural resource development opportunities along the way. On the right-hand side is a more simplistic map, with the black line being the current rail belt, red being the proposed phase one of Ribbit, and blue being proposed phase two of Ribbit. Next slide. This thing has been planned and vetted to death. I'm sorry, folks, was involved in a lot of this, but, you know, at some point you got to take the plan and run with it, you know. This was the number one priority for the Copper Valley Regional Energy Plan through AEA. It was in the top priority. When I say top priority, that's in the top three or four of the statewide energy plan with AEA. It was a top priority with the Copper Valley Regional SEDS. SEDS is through the U.S. Economic Development Administration. It is a comprehensive economic development strategy. It was a top priority. You can't really have a lot of economic development if you're paying exorbitant electrical prices. Statewide SEDS, it was a top priority there. That was done both with the U.S. EDA and the State of Alaska Division of Economic Development. The Otna Tribal Energy Plan has made it the number one priority to the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Indian Energy. TNNR Chiefs Conference, it's a top priority. TNNR Chiefs Conference SEDS, a top priority. And the Fairbanks North Star Borough SEDS, a top priority. By the way, Madam Chair, at any point, feel free to stop me in my tracks. I talk a little fast. I'm originally from New York.
Thank you. We appreciate that. We do have a question here from Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. Mr. Hoke, could you tell me what where the power generation locations currently are that you would be tying together? So does Sutton have its own power production, and Glen Allen has its own, and Gacona has its own, and what their power production means? Are they all diesel-powered, or...?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the power generation sources are primarily with the rail belt. I will let defer most of that question to Mr. Duhamel, as he is more of an expert on the utilities and their capacities. As far as anything beyond Sutton, we are all microgrids. All these communities are small microgrids, diesel generation of electricity primarily, self-contained units, if that helps.
And follow?
I'll ask the next person.
Okay. All right. Please continue.
With the slideshow?
Okay.
There we go. Support and resolutions. This was AFN's only energy resolution in 2017. Okay. This is a pretty big deal. I think Native organizations impacted and supported approximately 12 governments, 12 tribal governments, 12 village corporations. Four ANCCAs are involved. The Intertribal Resource Commission, Tananaw Chiefs Conference, Copper River Native Association. We have a letter of support from the Native Village of Chickaloon and many, many more. The utilities, including Copper Valley Electric, AP&T and MEA, Golden Valley, and the Alaska Power Association itself. The regional arter is on board with this. We have support from the Chamber of Commerce and many, many more. Meetings and discussions have occurred. You know, I think one of the issues back in the 90s that happened is it was kind of a take it or leave it type of situation. Nobody wants this running through their backyard or to disrupt other businesses or residents. So myself and Travis Million, who is COO of Copper Valley Electrical, has gone up and down the highway to many of the smaller communities along this route and had meetings just to try and feel them out and let them know that, hey, we're here, we want to work with you. You know, part of the recon engineer's report is finding out where's a good location, where's a bad location, what needs to go underground, what needs to go above ground, and some of the preferences therein. So I think that's trying to help in this whole endeavor. Next slide, please. Current costs and consumptions inhibiting development. Most communities in this area are paying 300 to 500% more than the national average. You know, if you go down to Chitna, commercial rate is about 88 cents a kilowatt hour. Think about that. How difficult is that to keep a mom-and-pop grocery store open? You know, you go up to Chistochina, same thing. Communities are electrified by all these microgrids. We're consuming approximately 4 million gallons of diesel per year for electrical production. This and other issues plague all of these small grids. PCE doesn't cover commercial electricity. Also, PCE is 60% of all electricity consumption in these communities. What does that mean? That, you know, your school districts, your post office, your DOT buildings, other state facilities or other federal facilities are not receiving PCE in these communities. Hence, the costs go up. Well, here's something I mentioned to Senator Bishop not too long ago. You know, the University of Alaska is running the HAARP facility. HAARP generates its own power and consumes 600 gallons of diesel per hour when on a campaign. Mm-hmm. Now, think about the savings that would have for the university system if now they're tied into a grid there. These electrical costs directly correlate to business and resident closure and relocation. Next slide. Economic and natural resource development. It's no wonder cheaper electrical power opens a door for business retention and expansion. It allows businesses to pencil things out. For instance, we almost had a Three Bears out here in Glen Ellen, but it just didn't pencil out with the cost of electricity. A number of years ago, Mr. Joe Bovey from Otna Incorporated and myself sat down with an investor from Oklahoma looking to start an OSB. OSB is your compressed particle board, not really particle board, but wafer board that is used in lieu of plywood. We could have had our own factory here, but the cost of electricity was prohibitive. It is a necessary infrastructure for economic development. The timber and lumber industry, such as OSB, lumber mills up in Tokyo, Young's Lumber Mill, which does a lot of the lumber processing for the North Slope, believe it or not. Right here in Gokana, we're trying to get a pellet and brick plant underway. It doesn't seem to pencil out with the cost of electricity. Mining operations such as Fort Knox, Pogo, Stellar, Tell Creek, Tetlin, 4th of July, they could all benefit from this. Some of them haven't even gotten off the ground because it has been cost prohibitive. Agriculture, which has been one of the industry clusters I've been trying to work in here at the Copper Valley, is a big beneficiary of the cheaper energy. How so, you say? Well, where does that water come from down in the ground but out of a pump? We have Tonsina North. The state of Alaska spent a lot of money and the federal government spent, I believe it was $2.4 million to divert the pipeline to get into Tonsina North Ag Development. Most of those folks, all of those folks back there are off-grid, but most of them with wells, it kills them to run the generator to pump the water out to try and water their fields. There's other things with agriculture to think of, too. Food hubs, value-added processing, or the secondary processing of some of the vegetables we grow. Penciling out the production. You know, we've got farmers down in Kenny Lake that would love to be growing potatoes, but with the high cost of pumping water out of the ground or pumping water to their farm, it's just cost prohibitive. Hydroponics, you know, we have the first seed grow in the state, which now Vertical Harvest Hydroponics is making down in Anchorage. They run on electricity. You know, all the lights, the pumps, it makes it very tough to pencil out. And it extends the growing season. I know my wife is going crazy right now trying to get all of her starts going, and with cheaper power, that means we can add light and heat at a cheaper rate. Tourism and outdoor rec. I don't know if anybody just saw the University of Alaska and the, I believe it was a Small Business Association, came out with a statistic that outdoor rec brings in $1.4 billion, I believe it was, to the state of Alaska. You know, they all benefit from cheaper electricity, as does fishing and the transportation industry. The Alaska pipeline also will benefit with this cheaper energy, as both pump station 8 and 9 are off-grid and isolated. Next slide, please. Yes, there are military benefits. Energy is national security. There's a list here, Black Rapids Training Facility, Donley Dome, Fort Greeley, Eielson, Fort Wainwright, Clear, all will benefit. The military necessitates redundancy, and they need cheaper energy with their growth. Not only with their growth, but the growth of the communities around them. Redundant, reliable energy is needed. Currently, there's an 80-megawatt bottleneck up near Eva Creek on the rail belt. Rivet offers a redundant loop with a solution. We can put more than 80 megs up this way, and we can offer that redundancy. Reduced costs for military with cheaper energy and redundancy means cheaper military budgets and more expansion. The other thing is a 25% renewable need that the military has, of which this valley and many other areas such as Delta could be pumping in more renewables into the ribbon. Next slide. Other information. There's a hierarchy of needs for infrastructure. Energy, transportation, and communication are, in my opinion, the top three. We already have two of the three out here on the road system. We have the transportation and the communication. This area out here is blessed with fiber optic and 4G cell. We need the cheaper energy. New industry and economic development means new revenue for the state. That means we don't have to dress up as a barrel of oil to get money from you guys anymore. The region is an unorganized borough, folks, and you, the legislature, are our governing body. And I think the majority of folks out here would like to keep it that way. This isn't just about the military. This isn't about mining or timber or other natural resource issues. This is about groceries versus the electric bill. How many people have to make that choice anymore? We're in America. This is about some of my former students that I had 20 years ago when I was a teacher up here, staying in their homeland or having to migrate outside or to the big cities. These are the real choices that we're talking about here at Rivet. Next slide. What do we need? Support from you folks. Just support. You know, the recon's estimated at about $2 million, soup to nuts, for an engineer's report. You know, with that engineer's report, we can hopefully go to our congressional delegation, who will help us find the appropriate federal agency that can assist in building this infrastructure, which, in my opinion, is the onus is on the federal government. Total cost of the project, these are estimates. Most of these estimates came kind of from the hip, from engineering firm in Anchorage. Phase one would be about $200 to $300 million. That's about two F-22s. Phase two would be About $100 million, which is about an Abrams tank. Listed here are some of the departments with the federal government that may be inclined to help this endeavor. Defense, energy, interior, commerce, agriculture. Along with state agencies, let's not take the state out of it, the approach to be able to contribute towards the deployment and construction of this intertie. Next one. Road Bell intertie. Who doesn't love Kermit? Ribbit. Questions, comments, cries of outrage, and thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate your presentation, and let's just see if we have other questions from committee members. Representative Rauscher?
Yes, Madam Chair. For the speaker, I was just wondering, what's the definition of soup to nuts?
Well, through the chair, Representative Rauscher, if you're going to a fine dining establishment, you're going to start with soup, and the very last thing they're going to do is bring out a bowl of nuts.
Thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that.
Technical term here, huh?
I guess.
Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you. Mr. Hoke, is it anticipated that this would be completely funded with federal dollars? And has the Department of Defense been on board with this conceptually? Or because it seems like they've got a lot of pieces where the military installations probably already have power generation and tying in more remote locations, but.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I would expect that a majority of this would come from the federal government. I know that not just the Department of Defense, which by the way, within your packet should be a testimony from Assistant Secretary of Defense for Environment, Energy and Infrastructure, Lucian Niemeyer, to Senator Sullivan, testifying that he would work with the road belt to develop the road belt intertie if the military necessitated such energy. The USDA is interested, especially RUS within and RUD within that department. Department of Energy is very interested. The Department of Commerce is very interested. I believe there's aspects of the Department of Interior that would benefit. For instance, the Native Village of Northway has attempted 8 different business plans through BIA economic development monies, and none of them pencil out without cheaper electricity. So I would say that there's a plethora of federal agencies that would be interested in building this infrastructure here in Alaska.
Follow up?
I have one last one. And you have it as a starting point, Sutton. And could you tell me, is that because Representative Rauscher lives there? Or no, is there excess power in Sutton, or is that currently the end of the transmission lines as they exist?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the latter. It's not because George lives there, no. It's because that's where the transmission line from MEA ends. However, there are distribution lines that run quite a ways out this way towards Glen Allen.
Okay. Thank you.
And Representative Rauscher, did you have another question?
Believe it or not, Madam Chair, that was going to be my question, only I wanted to know, I was going to define it a little better. Is it going to start at the substation in Sutton? And I guess that precluded my answer. So I assume that's correct. The substation in Sutton is where it's going to start.
If I may, Madam Chair, mm-hmm. Representative Rauscher, mm-hmm. That's why we need the reconnaissance engineer's report. Where is this going to really start? Is it going to start at the substation? Maybe it starts down in Palmer. I don't know. Mm-hmm. That's why we need this engineer's report for clarification on many of these minute issues.
Follow up?
Uh-huh.
Then should we just do a clarification on Palmer as a starting point, in case the engineering may preclude, you need to go closer to the source?
Mr. Hope?
Madam Chair, to Representative Rauscher, I don't think that there's a need for that kind of clarification. I think that support is support. You know, it's like it's not very far distance, 15 miles, but support for this as a concept piece of infrastructure within the state of Alaska is really what's at hand here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Sponholz has a question.
Thank you. I have a couple, actually.
Oh, sure.
One is, you know, in the end of your presentation, you describe, you know, the need for a recon engineer's report, and then it has the cost of the project sort of estimates. And I understand that those are pretty rough. After this resolution, presuming this resolution passes, what's the sort of the next step in terms of securing funding? Is there upcoming decision points or a strategy that you're working on right now?
Representative Sponholz, through the chair, I would say yes. I've been working quite hard at trying to secure the recon money at this juncture. Our plan is to hopefully get that, whether it be through federal or state sources. The estimates for the recon are all total about $2 million, $1 million for phase one, about $1 million for phase two. And those numbers come from Dryden and LaRue, and they're from the hip, and they're about a year and a half old right now. But if we can get that recon money, I'm fairly confident we can keep, you know, pounding the bricks with the federal agencies. I think this resolution sends a message to our congressional delegation, as well as to the agencies in Washington, D.C., that, hey, most of the lower 48 has benefited from years of infrastructure buildup, even prior, much of it prior before we became a state. And we'd like to get a hand up.
Follow up. So, are you then planning to take this resolution and go have meetings with members of our federal delegation then?
Ma'am, through the chair, I already have. And this resolution, I think, would speak volumes not only to our congressional delegation, but to the agencies in Washington.
So just to clarify, anything very specific right now that you're looking at that you're comfortable sharing with the committee?
There is nothing nailed down at this juncture.
Okay. My final question was, you have a great long list of supporters, and there's lots of resolutions that are attached to this. Is there any opposition in the communities that would be impacted to this project?
As far as opposition, do you mean vehemently and directly opposed to this project, or to perhaps the details of the project? If you're talking about the details of the project, yes, some folks, and like down there in Sutton, where Representative Rausch is from, there's a bottleneck down there. That community is kind of squeezed against the river. They're already losing ground from the Matanuska River. And, you know, I'm sure they wouldn't want transmission lines running right over the top of their house or through their yard. So, you know, we've talked to them. Yes, okay, this is when the engineer's report gets done, the recon gets done, this is a time for them to say, hey, we would prefer this underground versus above ground. Is that opposition? No, I don't think so. I think that's more or less mitigating issues that people may have.
So basically, you think that most of the feedback has been regard specific details or the way that it's done, not whether or not it should be done.
Correct, ma'am. And you know, to when we did our community meeting in Sutton, most of the folks, when they realized that, you know, the military needs redundant power and more of it, we will and say, yeah, okay, I'll work with you on this. You know, when and if this comes to fruition, we'll work with the engineers to see how we can mitigate all of the issues. We may be able to bypass Sutton altogether. I don't know. You know whether that's for the engineer's report to determine.
Thank you.
Did you, Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, thank you for, Madam Chair, giving me a chance to speak as a representative for the District 9 area, the majority of the line going from Palmer to Glen Allen, and a co-sponsor actually on this bill. I just want to make a kind of a public statement that Sutton is concerned and that they would like to see it mitigated to where it could go underground possibly and follow, well, go underground and follow the existing line. And I'm, as a representative, I need to actually make that statement. I believe that it is going to be mitigated in that way, and that is my understanding, and that is why I still support it. And I'm looking forward to working with the project in that respect. So I just wanted to make a statement more than a question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Rauscher. I appreciate that, and gives us that aren't from the area some understanding of the details. Any other questions for the presenter? Okay, well, thank you so much, Mr. Hope. We really appreciate you joining us today and giving us this great presentation. I just want,
Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. I just want to make note for folks that are online for HB 16, we have one more shorter presentation on HJR 10. I imagine take maybe 10 or 15 more minutes on this, and then we'll be transitioning to that public testimony. So I just want to give you a little bit of a heads up, and hope you can continue online for a few more moments. The second invited testimony here is John Duhamel. I think I said that possibly close to correct. And so if you wouldn't mind, we have your PowerPoint here in front of us. I think Julie is prepared to help you change the slides. And if you could state your name for the record, and we'd enjoy having your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me all right?
We sure can.
Okay, you should be looking at slide one. I'm John Duhamel. I'm the CEO of Copper Valley Electric Association. I'm testifying today in support of HJR 10, and I realize we are starting to run out of time, so I'll go fairly quickly here. I'll add to Jason Hope's presentation, as he listed the benefits of the region, with a power utility point of view. So I want to explain to people here how the project would be good for the power utility, as well as all the isolated grids along the way up the Richardson Highway that are associated or come within the region of this project. Slide two. Before I can describe to you the benefits of this, how the benefits that are brought by this concept to the industry, I'd like to take a minute to help others that may be on the line listening that don't know all the terms and principles associated with electricity. I promise to be brief and not too technical. To begin, when we talk about moving electricity, we refer to distribution power and transmission power. Distribution power is our low voltages. It's power that's moved to the end user, which we refer to as our residential, small commercial, large commercial, and in some cases industrial customers. And distribution systems are always maintained by the utility. Transmission and subtransmission power are high voltages, and it's moving large amounts of power between communities, usually from substation to substation. In Alaska, we have both utility and state-managed transmission. The Road Belt Intertie Project is a transmission sub-transmission only project, so it does not involve distribution. The most important point that I can make today is to tell you that transmission is infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Not all consider this by the general public, and there is a notion that power companies have sole responsibility over transmission, but transmission is very much like a road that connects population areas, and instead, it's really connecting energy or transportation of energy. Slide three.
Mr. Duhamel, it sounds like you could be using a speakerphone, and it's not that it's not loud enough. It's not quite as clear as it might otherwise be if you're able to use a handset?
Is this any better, Madam Chair?
Yes, that is better. We just get a little bit of an echo on the sound system here. Thank you.
Oh, I apologize. So on slide 3, this is just a simple pictorial of what I'm describing. Transmission would be the top part of the picture. That's where power plants produce the power and then move the power to a substation. Distribution is the lower part of the picture where residential and commercial users are connected in. The typical voltages used in these types of systems are shown there. The higher voltages require bigger wires, which require bigger structures and taller structures. And that is probably why, for a casual observer, it might think that the cost seems high that Jason has tossed out, which are as he said, very early in the process. Those projections would be defined as the reconnaissance study proceeded. But those bigger structures and larger conductors are what drives the cost up. Slide 4. We refer to this system of wires and structures and substations as the grid. The bigger the grid, the more resilient it becomes. This means it can absorb fluctuations easier and provide a more stable service to all the users connected to the grid. For a small grid, a simple tree in the line could take out the entire grid. A large grid will be able to withstand that fluctuation, and maybe only a few users or even no users would lose power with such an event. Other things to note, renewable energy, such as wind and solar, is variable. So a bigger grid allows more opportunities to accept producers of renewable resources. In addition, it is important to note, as Jason mentioned earlier, that power flows in any direction in a grid. So if the grid is set up in a loop or a loop-type feed, power can still get to any home or user despite a major disruption somewhere on the loop. The other interesting thing to note about a bigger grid is economy of scales, which means that everyone's costs are better. Despite the benefit of connecting the Richardson Highway and Copper Valley Electric, we're not the only winners. The current rail belt also wins because of that economy of scales. Slide 5. As Jason mentioned, the concept's not new. And so this resolution is not a radical idea that needs considerable vetting. In fact, it's been vetted, and it was a specific finding in the Alaska Energy Task Force study in 2003. What I did was I grabbed a page out of that study and just show you the map here. What it describes is the rail belt on the left side, the circles on the left side, are connected by solid line, meaning that transmission system's already in place. And the recommendation of the study is the dotted lines, which is really the project that Jason described earlier. Slide 6. Here's what I call the window of opportunity. All places in this window have isolated grids. That means they produce their own power or they live without power. There was a question earlier about how is that power produced? And there's a various a difference in the way power is produced throughout the area. So there is some solar, there's some hydropower, there's some wind. But for the most part, this entire window here is produced, the power is produced by fossil fuel. All these locations would benefit greatly by a leak feed grid recommended by the rail belt, the road belt intertie.
We have a question from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Dumal, through the chair. Are any of those productions currently producing excess power, or each of the independent isolated grid locations just producing enough power for their current demands?
Through the chair to the representative, that's a great question. There are, in some areas, surplus power, but it's not cheap power. So, for example, just looking at Copper Valley Electric Association, we have additional capacity through diesel. In the summertime, we do have a slight overage of hydropower, which we could, if we did have this road belt intertie, we could feed back into the loop grid and actually provide hydropower to more customers. The key to this project is that once we tie in, we would tap additional capacity with natural gas, because there is an overcapacity of natural gas in the rail belt. So the main benefit would be is to get that additional natural gas capacity to the rest of the state.
Go follow up.
Sure.
In the map, it has a couple of locations like 5 Mile Hydro, Chitna Wind, and Galkana Pellet Mill. Are those all producing power currently, or are those future ideas? Chickaloon Wind.
Yeah, through the chair to the representative, they are, from what I understand, and this map was developed by the Alaska Energy Association, they are all isolated grids.
And currently producing power?
Through the chair, I believe so.
Okay. Thank you. I just, and I do see that Sutton's slightly outside that box. We want to make sure that Representative Rauscher's property does get included on that transmission line. I don't want to see Sutton left out.
Thank you.
Through the chair to the representative, the reason we edged next to it is they are already, they are not an isolated grid at Sutton. They're connected into the MEA system. So we're trying to show as the window of opportunity those that would greatly benefit. And as I said, those that are, everyone that's connected to the rail belt would also benefit from economy of scales. Slide 7, please. From a power utility point of view, this summarizes our key points. A larger grid is good for everyone connected. We currently have an overage of capacity and a shortage of customers for our cheapest producer, such as our natural gas power plants. The concept will bring together struggling isolated grids. Bringing a bigger grid improves reliability and reduces outages. The rail belt intertie would allow more renewable energy to help meet future state or federal goals in reducing emissions. It opens up a potential of new sources. It also gives power choices to areas that currently have little choices at all. So, for example, some of these isolated grids that are only using fossil fuel, they'll now be able to choose whether they want to generate power with fossil fuel or whether they want natural gas. In a case of Copper Valley Electric, this is important because during our hydro season, we would certainly want to use our renewable energy. We wouldn't be accepting power from natural gas because we believe we can produce power even cheaper with our hydropower. However, in the wintertime, we certainly could utilize some of the natural gas power that's developed by the rail belt. And slide 8, and then my final slide. All that said, here's why the utility industry is in favor of this resolution. HR 10 gives credibility to the concept. It tells our congressional delegation, federal departments, and the White House we're united in ameliorating our high cost of energy. HR 10 allows our renewable opportunity, allows more renewable opportunities to meet renewable goals. HR 10 supports our request for federal funds with more credibility. HR 10 revitalizes the concept we've already validated in the past, and it helps Alaska get federal infrastructure funds. The reason that an old concept seems to have renewed energy now is that there's a possibility that some infrastructure money could break loose out of the federal government, and we'd like to be able to strike when the iron's hot on these resources if they do become available. And thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate your time, and I take any questions.
Representative Hannon has a question.
I have one more. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Rauscher raised a question, a point earlier, and so I'm just curious about transmission lines' ability to be buried. I certainly know of distribution lines being buried, but most commonly it always seems that big transmission lines are above ground and highly visible. But I don't know any of the engineering behind it. So are transmission lines able to be buried and still produce what and transmit what we need? Can that be dependent on the geography, or is there something in the electrical capacity about transmission lines that doesn't lend itself to being buried?
Through the chair to the representative, that is a really an excellent question. There are all kinds of methods that we would look at in the reconnaissance study. Our preference in Alaska is to have above ground lines. There's many reasons for that preference, that we don't want to dig down into permafrost. We can repair easily in the wintertime when the ground's frozen, but the ability to bury transmission lines are definitely a technology that's already out there, and there are transmission lines that do get buried in various places. I don't know of any right off hand in Alaska, but definitely in the lower 48. So the technology is there. But the question with Sutton, which, as Representative Rauscher said, you know, there is a concern about the view and the impact on their community because, as Jason said, they are pushed right up against the river and they don't have a lot of flat land. The study would look at going around Sutton, taking a different route, or burying. I mean, there are several options here that we'd be taking a look at. So what we think is important, and Jason mentioned it a little bit earlier, is getting out in the communities, seeing what their concerns are, and then developing those workarounds based on the concerns of the citizens that are going to be impacted by it. And we think we can, just knowing the technical parts about electricity and transmission, we think we can make everyone happy, or at least not angry, and benefit the entire state with this project.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Duhamel, I did just have one comment. You know, your slide said that this had been included in the work that was done in 2003, and it just... I think, gosh, it's too bad we didn't sort of like take that statewide perspective all those years ago, and maybe we'd be a little farther along. But the another project that is looking at more integration of the grid is on the rail belt side of things, and for similar reasons, you know, you could make it more low cost, you could make it more efficient. It would allow, you know, more like the on demand, so you'd use whoever has power first, as I understand it. So I know that that's happening along the rail belt. And so will this, you know, be able to be integrated into that so that we sort of have more of a statewide plan? Or do you kind of keep it separate because does that get too big? I just don't know at what point you've sort of like maxed out your opportunity for interties and efficiency.
Yes, Madam Chair, as I stated in my presentation, the bigger the grid, the better. In the lower 48, the grid is gigantic, and it's actually a good thing when it's that big because that large grid absorbs all kinds of fluctuations. But there is a necessary management entity, or in some cases several entities, that decide or make determinations on what power is utilized into the grid, and that certainly would be looked at so that It's the benefit of the whole, so that whoever can produce the cheapest power, they would get first push into the system, and then as you can continue to produce cheaper power or in line, maybe not as cheap as the first push, but the second, third, or fourth. So those decisions are made based on the peaks, mm-hmm. the peak loads, and how they occur. So in some cases, you may see, let's say, that the peak load is bigger than those cheaper producers can produce. Rather than turning lights out, they will go to a more expensive producer. But in the scheme of things with Alaska, there is enough capacity there that the production of power would be significantly cheaper than any of the power produced by these isolated grids. I hope I answered your question, Madam Chair.
You did. Thank you so much. And so I just want to understand then, because when I think about a class I took for this job, this energy class we took, we look at those in the lower 48 grids, millions and millions of customers, but smaller geographic areas. And so I just wasn't sure the bigger is better kind of thing is more number of customers or geographically, because we're so much larger than some of these other places, if we exceed like the geographic limitations for that. But it sounds like no, that we could be all integrated.
Yes, Madam Chair. And you are correct in that a very large grid actually has what we call line loss. It has a bigger ability for line loss, but that's really insignificant. So the geographic size is really minimal as far as causing anybody any difficulties. And the number of customers is really not what we're shooting for. What we're shooting for is the number of kilowatt-hour users or sales. So the more kilowatt-hours you use, then that economy of scales kicks in. So in Alaska, more customers aren't necessarily going to drive that economy of scales, but more kilowatt-hour use will. Mm-hmm. So it can get a little bit complicated, but you are correct in that a large geographic grid it's not all positive. There are some negatives, but they're really minuscule in comparison to the other benefits we get out of the project.
Thank you so much. So interesting to learn about. Representative Svanholz has another question.
Yeah, thank you. As you were talking about sort of economic distribution of energy along the road belt intertie, it occurred to me, is it possible that this project could allow this area of the state to plug into our rail belt transmission system at some point in time?
Through the chair to the representative, it definitely what we're trying to achieve is this loop feed would actually, part of that loop would be the rail belt. So you could imagine that if we're connected in at Delta, well, then the loop from the rail belt is Delta to Fairbanks, mm-hmm. Fairbanks to Palmer, Palmer to Sutton, and then the project loop or the road belt intertie that we're talking about here would continue from Sutton all the way back up to Delta. So this is really only a piece of the loop, or mm-hmm. it might even be a third to a half of the loop. But definitely the major part of this is the rail belt.
Follow up? Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just sort of thinking that, we're in the Energy Committee. You made this presentation in the Energy Committee maybe 2 weeks ago now. And we're going to be hearing about the Transco that's being sort of developed right now, and it's exciting for me to think about the way that all of these projects could support one another as we're trying to get the highest energy efficiency, being used to the maximum rate for ratepayers throughout the state of Alaska, as well as creating more redundancy in our system, which I think, you know, the earthquake recently just really underscored the need for redundancy in our energy system to make sure that we have maximum energy stability in communities across the state. So I'm intrigued by this. Thanks.
Okay, well, I think that wraps up your portion of this, Mr. Duhamel. Really appreciate you being available with us today. Thank you. And then just again, thank you. For folks for HB 16, we're just about to transition to that. We have one individual signed up here for the public testimony on HDR 10 to wrap up. So I'm going to open up public testimony for HDR 10, and I'm going to go to Crystal.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me all right?
We sure can. Please go ahead.
Okay, great. And I apologize, I'm getting an echo here on my end. Good afternoon. My name is Crystal Inkfist, and I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Power Association, the statewide electric utility trade association. Alaska Power Association strongly supports the deployment of electric transmission infrastructure that brings reliable electricity to Alaskans and stimulates economic development. The Roosevelt Electrical Transmission Line project currently being explored by the Copper Valley Electric Association and the Copper Valley Development Association, with the support of various stakeholder groups, would connect that region of the state to the Rail Belt transmission grid. The transmission project, should it receive the necessary funding support from the federal government, would increase Alaska's electric system reliability, allow for the integration of more renewable energy, enhance the reliability of power to military installations, provide an alternate power route for the Anchorage Fairbanks intertie, and enable economic development opportunities in the greater Copper Valley region. As indicated in our letter dated December 8, 2017, Alaska Power Association supports the efforts underway for the Road Belt Electrical Transmission Line project, including the analysis of transmission infrastructure options to achieve increased reliability and more affordable electric rates for residents in the Copper Valley Richardson Highway region. And thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Enkvist. We appreciate your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Okay. Thank you again. Anyone in the room wishing to testify on HJR 10? Okay. Seeing no one, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. We are going to hold HJR 10 for our next meeting. And so we would ask members if you could please have any amendments to us by 1 p.m. on Sunday for distribution for the meeting on Monday when we plan to bring this back up. Representative Tallarico, any last comments?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank
okay.
you.
Excellent. Okay. We are going to transition to our third item then now, which is House Bill 16. If folks recall, we have introduced this bill previously, and so we have the public testimony. We were very short on time when we introduced the bill, so we are doing the public testimony. I want to go to that first because folks have been waiting a little while for the public testimony, and I just want to make note that we have Bob Gerlach, the state veterinarian, online for afterwards for questions, as well as Pete Kennedy, who was the attorney from Weston A. Price Foundation, who spoke about sort of legal issues and is very knowledgeable about what's happening across the country. So those two will hope can stay on for the questions if anyone's interested, and we'll go right into the public testimony. And folks, when you introduce yourselves, if you wouldn't mind saying your name and if you have a business you're associated with and what district or where you live, that would be helpful for folks to know that about you. So first up is Art Griswold.
Yes, my name's Art Griswold. I'm representing Golden Heart Dairy, which is my two sons, and we have a raw milk dairy. We're distributing right now in the Fairbanks area over a half ton at least once a week. I'm in favor of the bill. I think the bill makes our life a little easier because that way we know where we stand. As it is right now, we do a membership program and a herd share program. We are running from 20 to 30 head all the time, and our goal is to come up with a 100-head dairy, but also become a grade A program. My sons, Nate and Adam, are 35 and 29, and they have started with two cows, and they're at this point now. Financing is a real nightmare for the dairy industry right now, but with a little time, I think the dairy industry will come to life again in Alaska, and I hope that people can support the program and get us, shall we say, a little more legal by having us in the state paperwork. That's about all I've got to say, and I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee for listening, and please look at the program because it's growing potentially. We look at possibly even having to go twice a week to Fairbanks shortly. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Griswold. Representative Rauscher has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I was just, you mentioned that you do, you sell milk, or at least in the Fairbanks area, but I'm wondering where the actual dairy actually is. Seems like you said you make the trip, so I just wanted to, everybody to know where your dairy actually is.
Through the chair, well, sure. My dairy is in Delta Junction right here, the Sun's Dairy.
Okay.
I'm 85 years old, so now you know why the Sun's have the dairy.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
85 years young. 85 years young. Representative Hannon has a question for you.
Thank you. Mr. Griswold, you mentioned liking to move to a grade A dairy. Could you tell me what that means compared to what you currently are?
Well, it means two things. One, we're going to have to construct and set up a creamery. And secondly, we have to get grade A inspections set up on the barns and the dairy itself.
Through the DEC.
Would that still allow you, you'd still be selling raw milk product? It's not a pasteurization ranking. It's just a DEC inspection of the milking barns. Is that correct?
Well, we want to stay with the raw milk market because it is a good market, but we also want to get into the grade A dairy and the retail market with a pasteurization and a complete plant.
Thank you.
The growth factor, we would be able to develop a dairy industry that used to be in the state with this area, and we can do the pasteurized product and the non-pasteurized product.
And Mr. Griswold, just to give folks a sense of that financial commitment, I think in one of our meetings in preparation with this bill, you talked a little bit about the investment that your family's made. This is Representative Tarr.
Yes, Representative Tarr. This is a major investment. The creamery equipment alone comes to $700,000. The barns and the whole project and the new creamery comes to 1.3 to 1.4 mil, which makes it a little hard to arrange financing because the feds have a cap of $300,000. We have to work through somebody else and then apply for guaranteed loans through the feds.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I just want to ask that question to, because when we talk about the food security piece of this and the ability for a farmer to start small and upsize, I just want to give folks a sense of sort of the financial commitment it takes you to get to that final stage. Representative Tuck also has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the chair, the with that investment, would that be able to increase your capacity, or what's the volume that you have now versus what you would be able to obtain by having that creamery license?
I'm sorry, I could hardly hear you, but it sounded like you wanted to know the volume of capacity with the investment. We will actually, looking at it, we'll triple our output of milk, of course, and our market is available in the Fairbanks area according to the studies we have, and Delta, and through the rest of the state. To be exact, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation people on their side have approached us as soon as we have the processed milk or pasteurized milk for sale. They would love to have it up on the slope. They can't. It's sticky wicket because we, for them to retail it, we have to be a grade A certified dairy and creamery.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Griswold. Great to hear your voice. We're going to go on to Susie Crosby. And Susie gave the sort of introductory. She was part of our invited testimony for press, the presentation, but she's testifying today for herself. Ms. Crosby? Do we have Susie? All right, Susie, I'm not sure if you have your phone muted or if we're not able to connect with you, but we'll go on to the next person, and then we can come back to you if we can get reconnected. John Anderson?
For the record, John Anderson. I am a member of the Board of Agriculture and Conservation, but today I will be talking or testifying for myself. And with that, I would like to throw my support behind House Bill 16, and I would like to thank the sponsor for this bill, as well as keeping it simple and not loading it down with other issues. This bill will help solidify a market for producers who currently sell raw milk products. It helps all other aspects of agriculture and keeps hundreds of thousands of dollars in state. Small producers who with this bill currently spend thousands on feed and supplies a year. Personally, while not a dairy farmer, I know our small farm spends close to $20,000 a year on just feed supplies. And all that money stays in state. That's money for hay farmers, grain farmers, the local feed stores, the supplements. That is all money and investment that stays within our local economy. With my support, though, I will put two issues that need to be addressed. The first being the MOVI issue. If the Board of Game places limitations on sheep and goat ownership, there will be a very narrow window of producers who this bill will now benefit, as opposed to hundreds of sheep and goat owners. So that's just something I would like the committee to think about. I would also like to ask for your help to encourage increase in farm insurance options.
Mr. Anderson, I apologize for interrupting you, but we're having a little bit of difficulty hearing you, and I just want to make sure we get these suggestions that you have, if you are able to maybe to be a little closer to the phone.
Sorry about that. I was reading my notes.
Okay, perfect. That we can hear you really well now.
So the two suggestions I have are the MOVI issue.
Mm-hmm.
If the Board of Game puts limitations on sheep and goat ownerships, this bill will now not only impact will essentially only impact cow owners, mm-hmm. because sheep and goat ownership will be potentially limited or possibly even banned altogether. I also would like to ask the committee's help for increasing farm insurance options. Right now, there's only one company that sells farm insurance in the state of Alaska, and previously, through law, even with herd shares, they would not allow for farm insurance. So obviously, anyone who wants to sell raw milk products while legal in the state of Alaska, could, if this bill passes, would have an issue getting insurance. And now you're putting a lot of liability on someone's farm, their home, to take that risk. So with that, I would like to answer any questions that the committee might have. And I would like to once again throw my support for House Bill 16, as well as to thank the sponsor for putting this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Really appreciate your testimony. Any questions from committee members? Yes. Rep. Hannon has a question.
Thank you. Through the chair, are you able currently, through herd sharing agreements, do you still carry farm insurance for liability of your product?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, no. Country Financial, which is the only farm insurance company in the state of Alaska, if you do sell raw milk products, you will not be able to get insurance.
Follow-up.
So could you help clarify for me then? So is the farm insurance limitations, it's because the raw milk is through herd sharing and no one covers that. But when you raise the issue of farm insurance, that's really separate than raw milk through herd share agreements? That's about the rest of the farm products that you have?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah, I'm not quite sure what you're asking. Sorry.
Well, I guess through the chair. I'm not sure when you raised farm insurance, because I had the impression that you already didn't have, that most herd share agreements, farmers don't carry insurance on that product. That's what herd sharing gets you around, because of many states not allowing raw milk sales. But maybe you could help by just expanding on what the need for increase of farm insurance coverage is for.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, thank you for the clarification. Yeah, so basically, if you were going to be now selling, let's say at a farmer's market, these products, you would have to, most farmer's markets require a certain liability insurance. So you would still need to have some bit of coverage to sell products. So, and that's if more of kind of on the food freedom portion of at least what originally was part of House Bill 16.
Mm-hmm. And so just for clarification, thank you, Mr. Anderson. Some earlier efforts, and if you look at what other states have done, some of their legislation has been more expansive. And we, I think, have avoided that with the very limited scope of this bill, but appreciate that point being brought forward, because we're not going to be doing retail sales or farmers market sales with this one, but appreciate that point. Representative Sponholz has a question.
I'm not sure if this is for the testifier or if it's for the bill sponsor, but clarification, we won't be selling, this bill won't allow the sale of milk at farmers market, but you could market your milk share or your cow share program or something.
Yes, Representative Sponholz. I mean, if someone, typically I think that would be restricted to somebody who would be selling some other product at the farmers market too, because you'd have to otherwise have a booth.
Right.
But you know, you're welcome to have like online advertising or, you know, website for the farm and, you know, the information about the herd share program. Mm-hmm. But then this wouldn't allow any sales at farmers markets. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Next, we're going to go to Amy Seitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Amy Seitz, Executive Director for the Alaska Farm Bureau, and we're an organization that really promotes expanding economic opportunities for our farmers and ranchers in Alaska. And as we've heard, agriculture in Alaska is growing, but we still have so much opportunity for continued growth, with 95% of purchased food being imported in. I mean, that's a lot of opportunity for us. So it's really important to find ways to help foster continued growth in agriculture. And House Bill 16 does take steps to achieve this. It gives some extra security to continuation of herd share programs, and it also opens up opportunities for expanding these operations through allowing access to the value-added products for herd share owners. And we appreciate efforts like this that help expand agriculture, they improve our food security, and they help keep more of the food dollars in Alaska. So I would like to encourage committee members to support passing House Bill 16, and I want to thank you and the committee for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Seitz. Appreciate you calling in. Any questions? Okay. Thank you so much. I think Susie is back online, so we'll go back to Susie.
Hi, this is Susie Crosby with Cottonwood Creek Farm.
Please go ahead.
Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Okay. So I am calling in support of House Bill 16. I think one of the first important things about it is that it does protect herd share from being randomly changed by the stroke of a pen of some future state official down the road. So that's important to all of us. And also being able to see the value-added products included in the definition of herd share would be huge. For those of you that have been following this bill, you may recall that Pete Kennedy from Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund stated his legal opinion that if a person has the right to choose to drink raw milk, which Alaskans currently do through herd share, then that person should also have the right to have that milk made into the product of their choice by the person of their choosing. And that just really makes a lot of sense to me. And I see broadening the terms of herd share to include such things as kefir, yogurt, cheese as a three-way win. Win number one, producers inevitably see a surplus of milk from spring through fall and a shortage in the winter. And it's been a challenge for us every year to find out ways to balance that uneven supply. And the very best way that we've ever found is to put away the maximum amount of milk in the least amount of space by making it into chef, a.k.a. goat cheese. And we put it in the freezer for use through the winter when production is low. And if we could legally market that, even that one item, to our herd share members, that added value would bring in, I'm putting this in farmers' terms, but each gallon of milk would bring in an extra bale of hay or thereabouts. Win number two, the consumers would benefit by having more locally made products available. One of the reasons herd share is growing in popularity is that people really want to know where their food comes from and keep that chain, food chain, as short as possible. If you Google the words locavore movement, you'll see so many websites devoted to this concept. It really is becoming the wave of the future. And whenever people taste our cheese, you know, we share it at parties and whatnot, the first thing they say after they say, wow, is usually the first question, hey, can I buy this from you? And I always have to say, sadly, no, it's not legal in Alaska, even through herd share. And it would just be awesome for consumers to have a legitimate avenue to purchase or, you know, through herd share, procure fresh, locally made cheese, yogurt, other value-added products. Win number three would be on behalf of the state, because the state's position is that they do not want to see raw milk products being distributed publicly and losing that chain of contact. So because these products would be within the restrictions of herd share, the closed loop scenario that is valued by the state stays intact. Herd share producers know who all their consumers are and can easily communicate with them as needed. And then by the same token, there's a direct line of communication from the consumer back to the producer in the event of any issues. And that's a far cry from making raw milk into a public commodity. The tracking ability would stay unchanged. I want to thank everyone on the committee for taking time to consider HB 16, and I would ask that you move forward and pass House Bill 16 for the benefit of everyone.
Thank you, Ms. Crosby. Appreciate your testimony. Any questions? Okay. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time today. We're going to continue on. Leslie Tompkins. And I should say, Susie's from Wasilla, I think, because we were saying where folks were from.
I was going to ask the question, yeah. But I didn't. I apologize.
And then Leslie, if she's online, from Wasilla. Okay. I know folks had to wait a bit. So, Leslie, if you can hear us or if there's this issue with the connection here, please just let us know when you get back online, and we'd be happy to have you testify. We'll go on then to Courtney Munson. Is Courtney available?
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can. Please state your name and go ahead.
My name is Courtney Munson. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I have a different perspective than everyone. So far, I'm a consumer of raw milk. I've been a part of a herd share program for several years now, and I just wanted to state my support for this bill and let the committee know how important this milk is to our family. I feel really strongly about the health benefits of it for myself and my kids. We drink the milk, we make it into cheese and yogurt, and some of my friends that are also in herd share programs don't have time to do that necessarily, so I think the fact that this allows for value-added products is really, really cool and important. Besides the health benefits, the other thing I really feel strongly about is that this is supporting our local food security and our food economy and bringing bringing us all closer to our food. You know, I try to buy as little from the grocery store as possible. I like to know where my food comes from, and I like to have a direct relationship with the people that are growing it or raising it for me if I'm not hunting, fishing, or growing it in my garden myself. So I think really we should all be moving toward more of a close connection with our food instead of expecting that we can just go to grocery stores and that someone else has decided that this is healthy, this is safe. So it's kind of like a personal responsibility thing for me. So anyway, I really appreciate that this bill was introduced and wanted to express my support.
Thank you so much, Ms. Munson. Really appreciate your call today. Any questions for the testifier? Okay, thank you so much. Did we get Leslie back online?
Leslie is who I get my milk from, and she was, I was just texting with her. She might be milking right now.
All right, I'm claiming that. I am certain that has not happened in a committee before. I'm claiming that one. Okay, well, we will continue on with public testimony.
Yeah, that answered.
Oh, she is here. Okay, all right, perfect. But I love it. It's like a milking interlude testifier. All right. Leslie.
Hey there. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Okay, I was milking a moody goat right then. So we are in Wasilla. We do some herd chairs. We milk goats and cows.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you please state your name?
Leslie Tompkins.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so we're in Wasilla. We milk goats and Jersey cows. We have some great herd chair members currently, so we would certainly be in support of the new revised language of bringing herd chairs to statute. And pretty much my point of view was pretty on point with what Susie had to say with adding some certain value-added products to people as well, using their milk to create some other products and letting those leave. I don't want to drone on and on, but I am in support of the new language.
Thank you very much. I am going to think about your comment of the moody goat and the milking interlude and really enjoy this. Thank you so much. Any questions for the testifier? Oh, okay.
But I appreciate your time and work on this.
Okay, thank you so much. We'll let you get back at it. Okay, continuing on, next is Gianna Thomas from Wasilla.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi there, this is Gianna Thomas.
Yes, please go ahead.
I am in support of House Bill 16. I feel like as a share owner that it recognizes my right to take my product to a person of my choice and have what I want done with it. I feel also that it helps support food security. We have one dairy left open to the public in the state, and if financial constraints require that we no longer have third-party inspection for that dairy, the only thing left is herd chairs where I am my own inspector. You know, I understand that pasteurization becomes necessary when you have a pool of milk from multiple farms with hundreds of animals on each farm, and you don't know somewhere in all those thousands of animals is probably one that is becoming sick but is not noticeable yet, so pasteurization is necessary. But when you have these small shares, I know which animal my milk came from, and I know the person that is managing my milk, and I trust that person. I want to hire that person to make my milk into a product that's actually even safer through heat treatment or enzymatic treatment or the addition of powerful beneficial bacteria in like a yogurt culture, kefir culture. And that way I can also inject more of my earnings into my local economy by paying somebody local to do that for me. I also know that most of the animals in Alaska are fed Alaska-grown grains and Alaska-grown forages and hay, and I feel like that keeps my dollars in state longer. I really appreciate that a lot of these farms that if they choose to offer a herd share to me, that Countrywide will not insure anything else on their farm. And so I really appreciate the sacrifices that they make, and that they understand that when I can see the process and I can see the animal, that I am my own inspector and that I trust them.
Thank you, Ms. Thomas. We really appreciate your testimony. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Rauscher had a comment. Representative Rauscher had a comment for you.
Yeah, did she have another statement she was wanting to squeeze in?
I might have. Ms. Thomas, did you have something else you wanted to say?
Yes, I currently own a share in a goat herd, but I do have a large flock of meat sheep, and we are moving out to a property where our flock will be able to expand. And in that expansion, there are quite a few individuals who have very good milk capacity, and I would like to offer shares to the public, sheep shares to the public. And currently, the sheep breed that I have are very seasonal milkers, and so I cannot offer a year-round share unless I can offer those value-added cheeses. And if you've been to the market lately, you'll notice that the only sheep cheeses really available are actually imported from Europe. And so we would have an extremely valuable niche market to be able to have sheep milk and sheep cheeses available in state.
Awesome. Thank you.
And Representative. Thank you, Madam Chair. I may not be able to ask my question now that I know she works with goats. I was just going to wonder what the price of a gallon of raw milk is going for right now, because I have no idea. And
well,
I was wondering if she knows.
Because we don't have large conglomerates that commingle their milk and are feeding a subsidized commercial diet, you have a true cost of about $10 a gallon. There aren't any feed subsidies. There's no byproduct industry up here off of oil feeds like soybean oil or corn oil. There's no corn meal or soy meal unless it's imported. And then it's obviously, if it's imported, it's not subsidized. So the true cost of a gallon of milk for us is around $10.
And follow up?
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, how many shares is the average goat and how many shares is the average cow? Would you know?
Well, I would say I have a 1/7 share, which means I pick up milk one day a week, and I get a gallon that day, and that's from a goat that weighs probably 150 pounds. A cow weighs probably 10 times that, so a cow would give 8 to 10 gallons a day, depending upon how much excess feed she's getting. She gets excess milk, whether she's in a calf share situation where the calf gets his one quarter and the shares get the other three quarters. And it depends upon the time of year. If she's just post-freshening, she's at the peak of lactation, or if she's at the tail end and being weaned off. So I would say that a cow could probably support 8 to 10 gallons a day for a large cow.
So is that 8 to 10 shares
in
that cow's ownership? If you understand I guess that's where I'm trying to go, is how many people are usually sharing part of this operation?
Totally up to
one cow.
The herd master.
Yeah.
So you could have a cow that has a one day a week share, 1/7 share, and you would then 10 gallons a week, and you might choose to pasteurize half of that and make yogurt, and you might choose to drink the other half of it, or you could use it for feeding chickens or hogs or other monogastric puppies. So it depends upon how much milk you want. If you buy that much share in an animal, if you want 50% of a cow share, then you will get 3.5 days of milk. That'd be 35 gallons, up to 35 gallons. And so that's up in the cheese making era, where you want to pull the moisture off and leave the fats and the proteins behind and make them shelf stable.
All right. I thank you. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We really appreciate that and your sharing your personal experience as well. Okay. We're going to go to the next testifier then. It's Tangy Bates. Is she still there? All right. Ms. Bates?
Hi, sorry.
That's okay. Yes.
This is Candy Bates.
Go ahead.
So I am also in support of this bill. I am a cow calf operation. And we also have dairy cows. So we appreciate the legislature's support on this, and you know, we still have some of the same concerns that other people have, like the insurance and so on and so forth. But you know, we need the legislature behind us to be able to continue to grow agriculture and livestock in the state of Alaska. So, and that's pretty much all I have to say. If anybody's got any questions.
Thank you. Appreciate your support. And we should say you're calling from Delta Junction, right?
We're from Delta Junction.
Okay. Representative Hannon has a question for you.
Thank you. Through the chair, how many shareholders do you have, and how many head of cow are you milking?
So I have a little bit different operation than some of the people that are here. I'm more of a seed stock operation, so I don't do a lot of shares. I'm breeding, and it's because of insurance. I'm breeding cows. So I have 35 milk cows, but we mainly are just trying to make mamas to go out to the general population. So we're just wanting to produce a cow that can be hand milked, machine milked, and then, you know, we sell them to the local homesteaders so that they can have a milk cow. Or if there's anybody in production, I've had a few people ask me about doing some, you know, wanting more cows to do production on their herd. So we're a little bit different than some of the people here. We're not really a big share operation. We're more seed stock.
And follow?
Does that answer your question? Not at all.
No, that does, but it produces another question, which is anybody doing meat share cows? Mm-hmm. Are you doing
that? I'm sure they are. I'm not really doing meat shares. We sell by the quarter, by the half on ours. We're more of a beef or operation. We do milk cows, but that's more so because my background is in artificially inseminating cattle. So I'm more on the, I'm trying to produce better genetics for the state of Alaska.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Rauscher wanted to say something.
Yeah, I have the question. So if you're producing cows, milk cows, how much is it? Mm-hmm. How much is it for me to buy a milk cow?
That's going to depend. On my crossbred cows, anything that's ready for lactation, I'm looking at $2,500. Anything that's purebred and ready for lactation, you're looking at $3,500.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. You might be getting some phone calls.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been up their way and seen it. We did a Delta Junction farm tour this summer. It was fun. Any other questions for our testifier? Okay.
I just want to say that, Minister, that there are people who do
yes.
meat share.
Yep.
And that's how they get around the USDA stamp.
Okay, that is all I have online for public testimony. Anyone here in the room wishing to testify? Okay, before I close public testimony, I do want to say that we have Pete Kennedy online. I don't know if there were any questions for Mr. Kennedy, but Mr. Kennedy, if you had any comments based on the testimony that we heard.
I agree with what Susie Crosby said, that this is going to benefit the state on several levels. The food dollars, you get more of your food dollars staying in the community with the value-added products. It'll give the farmers a better opportunity to earn a living, and I don't think they'll, these are all products, like Susie mentioned, that have just as good or even better track records for safety than raw milk. I mentioned last week at the hearing that butter, there's, in the Center for Disease Control database, there's no record of any foodborne illness outbreak attributed to the consumption of raw butter for the 20 years or so that the CDC has maintained the database, and there's plenty of raw butter produced in the state like California. So I think it's a win-win all around.
Thank you so much, Mr. Kennedy. Any questions for Mr. Kennedy? Okay, well, we really appreciate your help. I think I mentioned at the first meeting, Mr. Kennedy had met with our food security subcommittee a couple different times this summer and really helped us navigate the national landscape and, you know, understand safety concerns and looking across states and what they were doing. And so it's just been really helpful to have your expertise. So we appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. And then do want to mention that we have Mr. Gerlach, the state veterinarian, online, if anybody has any questions for Mr. Gerlach. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Gerlach, thank you for being with us today. And can you tell me how many herd share operations we have in Alaska?
Yes, this is Bob Gerlach. I'm the state veterinarian for Alaska. And through the chair, we do not keep any record of the number of herd share operators or any farms in the state. That's not a part of what we do. The from reports and from talking to people that there could be several just in the Matsu Valley of between a dozen or two dozen, and I would expect that there probably would be some up in maybe a little bit less than that up in the interior.
Any follow-up?
Follow-up. Mm-hmm. Let me shift gears then. Tell me, can you confirm that we have only one commercial dairy that has full licensure to sell products retail in Alaska currently?
That's correct. There's one dairy out in the Mat Valley, Havemeister Dairy, that is has a permit for the dairy farm itself as well as for the processing pasteurizing plant, and that then we have one other permitted facility, which is the blow mold or the milk container plant that's out in the valley that supplies the containers for that Havemeister dairy.
And one more follow-up through the chair. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like we have a lot of milking capacity across the state, yet we haven't made that leap into putting them into a full retail situation. And I understand the complexities of the law. But could you guide me as to what other links in the chain we would need to remedy to bring raw milk and cheeses into full commercial retail operations across Alaska?
Well, currently, state regulations prohibit the distribution or sale of raw milk to consumers or to any retail sale. The regulations do not prohibit, you know, the individual choice for people to consume raw milk, and the fact that they don't restrict those personal freedoms in allowing people who own milk or milk-producing animals to go ahead and consume that milk. And the and that would include from what had been previously stated was that it would also include people who own a portion of an animal through a share operation. But I want to make sure that part of the current regulations that are on the books now, the 18 AAC 32.010 prohibit, they allow the consumption of milk, raw milk, by the owner of the animal for that person's personal use, but does not permit the processing of that milk into products for distribution to owners. So it would only be the person who has that owns that animal or a portion of that animal, takes that raw milk, and then processes it themselves, that they would be able to consume that raw milk product.
That's current. Representative Rauscher has a question. Okay. Representative Rauscher?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing we haven't discussed yet today, and I thought this would be a perfect person to discuss it with, Doctor, is the precautions. What are the precautions that we need to understand when it comes to raw milk?
Raw milk is considered a high-risk product for foodborne pathogens, and for two reasons. One is that cattle and goats can shed different pathogens directly into the milk, and they don't necessarily show any sign of illness. The other issue being the environment where that milk is harvested and the lifestyle of the animals. That environment often adds to contribution to pathogens being introduced into that milk product. Well, when you look at national surveys of raw milk, and this is just milk that's collected from both grade A dairies and from other raw milk dairies across the country, there were studies that found up to 12% of the milk samples collected contained at least one pathogenic bacteria in that product, and that's the concern for the exposure or consumption of a raw milk product. The obviously the amount of contamination that may be found may vary from farm to farm, and dealing with the number of animals and the husbandry on the farm. The process of the milk program that the state operates is the fact that we have oversight of the individual farm to make sure the animals are healthy and raised properly on that farm, and then monitor the transfer of milk to the processing plant, and at that time point restrict the milk, the raw milk, that if it has a higher bacterial count, that would not even be allowed to be processed. The other thing that gets evaluated in the dairy program is the presence of any adulterants. For example, the state lab, as well as the laboratory that's at the pasteurization plant, will test each batch of milk prior to pasteurization for the presence of any antibiotics.
Thank you, Doctor. Appreciate it.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, Dr. Gerlach. Appreciate you being online for us today and sharing that information. I did want to mention that Tiana, who had testified, wanted to make a correction that the cost is actually $10 for a half gallon, not a full gallon, $10 for a half gallon. Okay. And so I know Ms. Thomas is online again. I don't know if that covers that, if there's something else. I just want to make sure to give you one quick opportunity to weigh back in.
Yes, I went to my fridge and I opened it and I realized that I gave the price per jar, which is $10 per jar. And my jars are, I receive my milk in half-gallon jars because they fit in the fridge better. And that reflects that these are a non-subsidized product that does not have the economies of scale of 1,000 cows per one milker. You've got like 5 cows per one milker. So there's a lot more investment hours put into each animal, and so the cost reflects that.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That completes our public testimony and folks that were online, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony because we didn't have anyone else here in the room. I don't know if there are any comments or questions or any other input from committee members. We didn't have any amendments. I guess just closing comments for me. I hope folks, it's like a topic we don't talk very much about here in the Resources Committee, right? But I think we gave like kind of the spectrum of why we're trying to provide more small business opportunities as well as the freedom for the consumers that want to have these products. And I appreciate Dr. Gerlach. We've tried to work closely with them because we do want to do everything safely. One of the things that reassures me is having visited some of these farms and knowing the folks is I think these animals in a lot of ways are almost more like pets, you know, become very, you know, in smaller operations, the care is very important. And you know, we saw from the earlier presentation with Ms. Crosby, you know, the cleanliness at each step of the way. And so I'm excited that we have these kind of folks that care so much and are making these products available in Alaska. And just like Mr. Griswold talked about, it's a hard stretch from the small to the big, and that middle part is really missing, and we're trying to kind of fill in that gap so we do get to a place where we actually have a functioning dairy industry in Alaska again. And I think if we could do it 100 years ago, then, you know, we ought to be able to figure it out now too, right? Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Representative Tarr. I appreciate you sponsoring this because it wasn't 100 years ago. We had a functioning dairy. When I grew up in Anchorage, you could get milk delivered to your door, and you were getting butter and cheese that were produced at Matt Valley Dairies. So we don't have to go back 100 years. And, you know, I would dream to see that Mr. Griswold's ability to sell on the North Slope and his milk and fresh milk being available across Alaska. It sounds like there are a lot more small herd share operations than I had any understanding of. Mm-hmm. So our ability to try and remove barriers and support businesses that would be regional in focus and able to deliver milk products and cheeses to Alaskans is something we should support. And this is a small step. It doesn't really expand the industry very much. It doesn't put it into any new locations, and it's only a cheese product to help bridge those small herd share operations. But I think we have the opportunity to expand our dairy agriculture substantially and restore it across Alaska. This community had dairies for a long time, mm-hmm. Until about 30 years ago, maybe, I guess, 40 years ago. Haynes had dairies, Gustavus had dairies, and those products haven't reduced in consumption. Mm-hmm. We've just switched to marketing them and everybody buying them from Washington and Oregon, and that's what our grocery stores provide. And the regulatory burden is there, and I appreciate the need to make sure consumers are safe and we have inspectors in place, but anything we can do to support small businesses being able to expand and serve their markets is laudable. So I appreciate your bill.
Thank you very much. Any other comments from committee members? Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, I do. I would like to echo all the comments made from Representative Hannon. And I also want to say that a lot of people remember the bill last year. This is not the same bill.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a different bill, mm-hmm. and I appreciate the bill. Probably would have supported last year's too, but this is a better bill, and I know that we, there was a lot of confusion last year. There was a lot of, it was kind of mixed in with a few things. So, and then withdrawn to help the better part of the other one keep going forward. So I just want those that are listening to understand that this is a different bill, but yet it accomplishes this part of it, and I appreciate you for bringing it up again this year.
Thank you very much. Representative Tallarico.
Madam Chair, I'd also like to echo those same sentiments. And I think the clarity that's provided here, because it seems like these questions came up, I want to say 4 or 5 years ago, you and I had actually discussed this and providing this clarity with the additional products and everything. So I really do appreciate it as well, and I'm very much in support.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Well, if there are no further comments from committee members, I would entertain a motion. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the sponsor substitute for House Bill 16. That is version 31-LS0215/U from committee with the individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay. Thank you very much. There's no additional business to come before us. We will sign the paperwork, seeing no objection there. But I wanted to remind folks about our meeting next Monday. We'll have the second hearing for HDR 10, supporting the railboat electric line. Also, in what we'd like to do when we have these presentations is to try to share all sides of an issue. So we heard from the Pebble folks. Last Monday. This Monday, we're going to get the project status and update on permitting and environmental impact statement. This is going to include some of the folks from the Bristol Bay region. And then just so folks know, later we will be hearing from the Army Corps of Engineers. So hopefully we're going to hear from every point of view, and everyone will have complete and thorough information on that. Also, please note that we have an extra meeting on Monday at 6:30 p.m. to complete our consideration of the Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner designee, Jason Bruni. And so hopefully that will give committee members, we had extensive testimony, and committee members didn't actually get an opportunity to have the typical committee hearing. So that's what that's all about. And we did our best with all of our nominees. Sometimes the scheduling can be a challenge because people have trips in and out of the state and things like that. So this is why we're doing the extra evening, because otherwise Mr. Bruni is headed off for two different commitments and would have delayed it until about April 12th or so. So that's why we need to have the extra meeting. Appreciate the participation from everyone. So I do need to say that House Bill 16 moved from committee. I need to get that on the record. So if you wouldn't mind just sticking around to sign the paperwork, and have a great weekend, everyone. Appreciate everyone's work this week. The time is 3:01 p.m., and this meeting is adjourned.